on your wandering in the wilderness of ignorance, possibility of losing the sight of the goal which you want to attain and of reaching the end aimed at, then it is better to give up the quest than to advance facing uncertain dangers and unforeseen risks. Advise people to do good and live virtuously because you are fit to give such advice. Let your words and deeds teach the world lessons of how to abstain from wickedness and vicious deeds. Try your best to keep away from those who indulge in vices and sins. Fight whenever required to defend the cause of Allah. When you think of defending the cause of Allah, do not be afraid that people will laugh at you, censure your action, or slander you. Fearlessly and boldly help truth and justice. Bear patiently the sufferings and face bravely the obstacles which come in your way when you follow truth and when you try to uphold it. Adhere to the cause of truth and justice wherever you find it. Try to be well versed with Islamic jurisprudence and theology and acquire a thorough knowledge of the canons of this religion.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
We are on two sides. Either you love Ali ibn Abi Talib or you hate Ali ibn Abi Talib. That's if you know Ali ibn Abi Talib. And that is why we find a hadith from our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. أَنَّهُ قَال لِعَلِيٍ يَا عَلِي لَا يُحِبُّكَ إِلَّا مُؤْمِنٍ وَلَا يُبْغِذُكَ إِلَّا مُنَافِقٍ. He says, oh Ali, no. That those who love you, that is a sign of iman. Yeah? And for those who hate you, that is a sign of nifaq, hypocrisy in their hearts. Now, we need to look, before we describe what is it about Imam Ali alayhi salam that makes him loved and hated at the same time so much, we need to have an introduction to understand this whole idea or this concept of this jazibiyya, as it is known in Arabic, this attraction. I don't have love for the person who curses Ali ibn Abi Talib. How? You tell me you have love for these people? The people who bomb and kill innocent Muslims and Shias in Sham, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. I say I have love for them? Let us look everything past? No. This is not Islam. Islam wants you to take a line and take a stance and say that I will not love these type of people and rather I will show and pray against these type of people. Now, when I meet these people, how will I behave? Naturally, the akhlaq of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam has to be maintained. Yeah? Has to be maintained, my brothers and sisters. I'm not saying we show no akhlaq to them. But in my heart, I have no room for these people. And I will not hang out with these people. I will not show friendship to these people unless they begin to change their way. Yeah? So this is the second group of people. People who only have the power of attraction. Then there's a third group of people. The third group of people are people who only have the power of repulsion. You meet them and you want to run away from them. They don't know how to talk. They don't know how to do anything. These are the people who don't have friends, don't make friends, and don't want friends. They would rather be all by themselves. In fact, these are the people who have no akhlaq. Because if they had an ounce of akhlaq, people would be willing to spend some time with them. But these are people who absolutely do not have the characteristic and the conduct of the Ahlul Bayt, and these are the people who we should avoid. There's a hadith which comes from our first Imam Amirul Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. أَنَّهُ قَالْ أَعَجَزُ النَّاسِ مَنْ عَجَزَ عَنِ الْإِكْتِسَابِ الْإِخْوَانِ. The weakest of man, the weakest of men is he who is too weak to attract a friend, he says. It's the weakest of men. He is too weak to even attract somebody to become his friend. And then he continues, وَأَعْجَزُ مِنْهُ مَنْ ضَيَّعَ مَنْ ظَفِرَ بِهِ مِنْهُمْ. And still weaker is the one who loses friends and becomes isolated. Why? Because they have no akhlaq. Yeah? You don't want to spend time with them. Why would you want to spend time with them? Somebody who doesn't treat you well. So these are the people who absolutely repel everybody else.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator Ofcom asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship, and the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine. These kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us, we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the Word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, and the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions.
At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saidpur is up, London.
He is referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran. Salah al-Zawawi has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his 4 decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981. And before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than 7 decades. After 4 decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare. And when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second, and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they're happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be canceled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban took over. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's parliament is reviewing the details of the budget bill for the next fiscal year, starting on March 21st. The government's proposed budget stands at roughly $148 billion, some 4% higher than last year's approved budget. Lawmakers have earlier approved the generalities of the budget bill, and it's been a week now since the thorough examination of the bill kicked off in parliament's open sessions.
The government's cap on next year's budget is roughly $148 billion. Out of this figure, $60 billion is allocated for the general budget and $88 billion is earmarked for government spending. Parliament is making some revisions, especially in national development projects and infrastructure. We increased the allocated budget in these areas.
This time, the budget's examination process took longer due to the fact that lawmakers want to be as meticulous as possible while evaluating the income and spending in the country.
While Iran and the P4 Plus One are engaged in tough negotiations in Vienna over the revival of the 2015 deal, President Ebrahim Raisi says the budget bill seeks to promote a resistance economy that would not need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions.
Parliament says the budget bill was drawn up based on a no-deal possibility in the Vienna talks and the continuation of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
The proposed budget expects the country's oil sales to reach 1.2 million barrels per day, with $60 a barrel, which would earn Iran some $14 billion in the fiscal year 2022-23. Lawmakers reset this figure to 1.4 million BPDs, with $70 a barrel. Any agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks will immediately push Iran's oil sales up by at least 500,000 BPDs as a result of the removal of U.S. oil embargoes on Iran. But lawmakers say they will not wait for the fate of the negotiations to finalize the budget bill, saying any extra petrodollar will be spent for the good of the people.
We cannot waste our time and wait if the U.S. removes the sanctions or not. So we set the budget based on a daily export of 1.4 million barrels of oil through direct or barter sales and based on assumptions that oil prices will hover around $70 when in fact the prices are reaching $100. Any extra oil income will be saved in a national development fund.
President Ebrahim Raisi submitted the budget bill to Parliament in mid-December last year when Parliament approved its general outlines. Lawmakers now have 3 weeks to go over the details and fix the shortcomings of the budget, to pass it into law before handing it to the higher legislative body, the Constitutional Council, for final approval. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held talks in Brussels to bolster the 27-nation bloc's second round of new sanctions against Russia over the Kremlin's military campaign in Ukraine.
Only leaders in the world we are sanctioned by the European Union, Assad from Syria, Lukashenko from Belarus, and now Putin from Russia.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also been added to the sanctions list. The idea is to block banks in the EU from making funds available to the two key Russian figures. Earlier on Friday, EU leaders agreed sanctions on Russia's energy, aviation and financial sectors.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defence.
Outside the EU leaders' summit, union members staged a peace demonstration.
We don't think to have a war in Ukraine is a good thing for European workers and for Ukrainian workers. So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy. The point has been made, there will be a realisation in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Afghans gathered to celebrate Eid al-Mubarak, an important day in the history of Islam on which the Prophet Muhammad was chosen as God's final messenger and started his prophetic mission. Participants paid tribute to the Grand Prophet of Islam and congratulated Muslims around the globe on this holy occasion.
I congratulate all Muslims worldwide on the anniversary of the Grand Eid al-Mab'ath. Prophet Muhammad was appointed as a messenger to enlighten the world and instruct people how to live. He taught us not to accept slavery and live freely. Afghans have proved that if we follow Islam, no one can defeat us.
Prophet Muhammad, as the final messenger of God, has been the best role model for humankind. He had the best personality and attributes. Prophet Muhammad says that he was sent to teach moral virtues to humanity. He serves as a teacher and as a savior for all Muslims and humanity.
Addressing the ceremony, speakers also emphasized the need for Islamic unity among all Muslims. They said one of the messages of the Prophet of Islam was to fight oppression, injustice, and devils.
We Muslim nations are obliged to follow Prophet Muhammad's path and study his teachings and thoughts. One of his messages to us is to get united. Second, he asks us to resist against devils, oppressors, and arrogant powers. That is when we will succeed.
Tuesday marks the anniversary of the beginning of the prophetic mission of Muhammad Rasulullah. Eid al-Mubarak is largely commemorated by the followers of Islam around the globe. As a Muslim nation, Afghans take this opportunity to strengthen the bonds of brotherhood and solidarity. They say the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was a messenger of kindness, peace, and justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. George Floyd's murder set in motion shockwaves that touched almost every aspect of American society. But under core issues of police violence and police accountability, very little is different. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Tim Arango and Julia Hayward. The piece is titled, Despite Uproar Over Floyd's Death, the Number of Fatal Encounters with Police Hasn't Changed. For a second time this year, a jury in Minneapolis has ruled against a former police officer for killing a black man. Like the conviction of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, the verdict on Thursday, 23rd of December, against Kimberly Potter on two counts of manslaughter for the shooting death of Daunte Wright during a traffic stop represented an unusual decision to send a police officer to prison. And yet, despite the two high-profile convictions in Minneapolis, a review of the data a year and a half after America's summer of protest shows that accountability for police officers who kill remains elusive, and that the sheer numbers of people killed in encounters with police have remained steady at an alarming level. The murder of George Floyd on a Minneapolis street corner drew millions to the streets in protest and set off a national reassessment on race that touches almost every aspect of American life, from corporate boardrooms to sports nicknames. But under core issues that set off the social unrest in the first place, that is police violence and police accountability, very little has changed. Since Mr. Floyd's death in May of last year, 1,646 people have been killed by the police, or about three people per day on average, according to Mapping Police Violence, a non-profit organization that tracks people killed by the police. Although murder or manslaughter charges against police officers have increased this year, criminal charges, much less convictions, remain exceptionally rare. That underscores both the benefit of the doubt usually accorded law officers who are often making life-or-death decisions in a split second, and the way the law and the power of police unions often protect officers, say activists and legal experts. The convictions of both Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who was captured on an excruciating bystander video pinning George Floyd to the ground for more than 9 minutes as he grasped for air, and Kimberly Potter, strike some experts as tantalizing glimpses of a legal system in flux. Kimberly Potter's case in particular reflected the kind of split-second decision she mistakenly used her gun instead of her taser after Daunte Wright tried to flee an arrest that jurors usually excuse even when something goes horribly wrong. Chris Uggen, a sociology and law professor at the University of Minnesota, said that even though the number of people killed by police remained prevalent, high-profile cases could still send a message to the police. The probability of punishment is not zero, he said, so it moves the needle to some degree, and it can certainly affect the behaviors of police officers. But many experts are reluctant to read too much into a few isolated cases carried out in the glare of media scrutiny. Criminal trials are not designed to be instruments of change, said Paul Butler, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a former prosecutor. Criminal trials are about bringing individual wrongdoers to justice, so while there have been high-profile prosecutions of police officers for killing black people, that doesn't, in and of itself, lead to the kind of systematic reform that might reduce police violence. Philip Stinson, a criminal justice professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, who tracks police criminal charges and convictions, said Kimberly Potter was the first female police officer convicted of a murder or manslaughter charge in an on-duty shooting incident since 2005. He said he believed that the number of deaths from excessive police force was higher than what was recorded and reflected in news coverage. Many police officers exhibit a fear of black people, he said. Until we can address that, it is very difficult to bring about meaningful reforms. Gloria J. Brown Marshall, a constitutional law professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, said accountability also needed to be aimed at prosecutors who gave police officers carte blanche for a century until the recent show of public outrage. Change is not likely to come anytime soon, she said. In these individual cases, justice won in the end, she said, but there is a lot of work that still needs to be done. Jim Pascoe, the executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police, said the rarity of criminal charges against police officers doesn't indicate a lack of accountability, but simply reflects that the vast majority of police shootings are lawful, with many occurring under dangerous circumstances where police officers have to make quick life or death decisions. There has been no finding of fault against police officers in many of the other recent high-profile cases of people killed in encounters with the police. Less than 3 weeks after the murder of George Floyd, an officer in Atlanta, Georgia, fatally shot a black man named Rayshard Brooks, who was fleeing a Wendy's parking lot after taking a taser from the officer's partner and firing it at him. The killing in Atlanta, Georgia, like that of George Floyd's, was captured on bystander video and drew protesters, adding to the demands for justice and accountability over the number of African Americans killed by the police. And about 2 months before George Floyd's murder, Breonna Taylor was killed in her Louisville apartment during a botched police raid that targeted an ex-boyfriend for alleged drug crimes. Her name, too, became familiar to millions of Americans. Yet the police officers involved in the Breonna Taylor case have largely been cleared, even as federal authorities continue to investigate. And in Atlanta, Georgia, Rayshard Brooks's case stalled this summer as it was passed to a third prosecutor, who is starting the investigation all over again. The police officer who shot Rayshard Brooks has been charged with murder, but there is no timeline for a trial. We are taking a fresh look at it and starting from day one, said Pete Skandalakis, a special prosecutor in Georgia who took over the case. He added that he could not predict when the case would see a courtroom. That has left Rayshard Brooks's family wondering if they will ever see justice. I think we're all just lost right now, said Chris Stewart, a lawyer who represents the Brooks family. We don't know what to think or what's going on. According to data kept by Philip Stinson and a research team at Bowling Green University in Ohio, 21 police officers this year have been charged with murder or manslaughter for an on-duty shooting, although 5 of the officers charged are for the same encounter, the killing in November of 2020 of a 15-year-old boy who was a suspect in an armed robbery. While this is an increase from the 16 police officers charged in 2020 and the highest number since Philip Stinton began compiling the data since 2005, it remains small next to the roughly 1,100 people killed by the police annually. Just as the pace of killing since George Floyd's death has remained largely unchanged, racial disparities have also stayed the same. Black people are still 2.5 to 3 times as likely as white people to be killed by a police officer, according to Mapping Police Violence. While Derek Chauvin's trial was underway in the spring, Daunte Wright's death at the hands of Kimberly Potter in Brooklyn Center, a Minneapolis suburb, set off new rounds of protests in the Twin Cities. And in the rest of America, the number of new cases of people killed in encounters with the police continued apace, some of them piercing the national consciousness and adding to the names protesters shouted in the streets. Among them were Adam Toledo, a 13-year-old Latino teenage boy who was killed by a Chicago police officer after running down a dark alleyway with a gun. And in Columbus, Ohio, shortly before the jury reached a decision in the Derek Chauvin trial, a 16-year-old black girl named Marcia Bryant was shot to death by an officer as she swung a knife at a young woman. A state agency investigated Marcia's death and in July turned its findings over to local prosecutors in Franklin County. At the time, the state attorney general said he expected it to take prosecutors several weeks to make a charging decision. But a spokeswoman for Gary Tyack, a county's top prosecutor, said the case was still under review 5 months later. More recently, at a high school football game in a suburb of Pennsylvania this fall, police officers opened fire amid a crowd after they heard gunshots, killing an 8-year-old black girl named Fanta Belitti. All of these cases remain under investigation, and no charges have been filed against the police officers involved. One of the reasons for Derek Chauvin's conviction was that the circumstances of the case differed so starkly from so many other cases in which police officers were cleared by prosecutors or by juries. There was no split-second decision made in an environment in which Derek Chauvin could argue that his life or those of other police officers was in danger. In the trial of Kimberly Potter, which played out in the same courtroom where Derek Chauvin was tried, her defense lawyers said Kimberly Potter acted reasonably in using force because she feared for the life of a fellow police officer, a scenario more emblematic of a typical police killing case. This time, though, that argument did not work.
He says that I get this tawfiq and chance to start offering this tafsir, and I wanted to conduct a kind of tafsir which is going to be beneficial for the ordinary people and lay people.
He tries to emphasize the ethical points of tafsir. That's why we may say that this tafsir is an akhlaqi exegetic book.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Surely we've wronged ourselves. What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So, as our dear listeners might know, the program The Teacher is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim, especially Shiite dignitaries all across the nation of Islam around the world on different fields of studies regarding Islamic studies. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about a Shiite alim and a scholar of the 14th century. According to the solar calendar, he is no one but Muhammad Saghafi Nuri, also known as Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani. Sheikh Ziyani, Allah is Saw with you, brother. Give us some information about the biography and the early life of Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani was born in 1273 solar calendar in Tehran. And he moved to Qom in 1341 in lunar calendar and studied for 7 years in Qom. And after that, he moved again to Tehran. And he stayed in Tehran the rest of his life up to his demise. And he was amongst those scholars that dedicated his life to live amongst people mm-hmm. and to be imam of a mosque and to have preaching Islam amongst ordinary people and, you know, among those people who are involved in ordinary, you know, jobs like merchants and some people like this.
Okay.
And it's important to know that Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani was the student of Mirza Kuchak Sawoji and also Sayyid Abu al-Hassan Rafi Ghazvini. And the most important teacher of him is the late Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi, the great alim who established yes. the yes. Islamic Seminary of Qom.
The founder of Islamic House
yes.
of Qom, that's right. Okay.
And also Sheikh Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani achieved the permission of Ijtihad, that, you know, certification from Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi and also Sheikh Muhammad Rza Isfahani.
That's right.
So this is the brief of his background.
Okay, that's right. As you said, he was very much related to the socio-political and religious scene of Iran, both before the Islamic Revolution and after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. And one of his daughters has become the wife of the late Imam Khomeini. The late Khadija Saghafi, you know, the daughter of this outstanding man and the wife of the late Ruhollah Khomeini, mainly known as Imam Khomeini. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, let's talk a little bit about the specific fields of study. I mean, the fields of interest of Ayatollah Saghafi Tehrani. What are they?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Regarding Ayatollah Saghafi Tehrani, we have to say, as my brother mentioned, he benefited from the great scholars like Abdul Karim Ha'iri. And besides him, we can mention the name of Ayatollah Shah Abadi, who is really famous as the teacher of akhlaq or ethics. This is actually the technical term that we have in Hausa,
yes.
or it's actually something famous among the Muslims to go and follow one specific teacher who is qualified and eligible for educating and giving instruction on akhlaq.
That's right.
So he was benefiting from the presence of Ayatollah Shah Abadi, that everybody, most of the, at least Iranian, know that Ayatollah Shah Abadi also was the teacher of akhlaq for Imam Khomeini as well. Imam Khomeini was, and this is also very interesting, that Ayatollah Shah Abadi was giving his lessons on akhlaq all days of the week. So they were participating in his class, and this is also narrated that Ayatollah Saghafi Tehrani yes. was also taking part in his private class. So in field of study, we can say most of the Hausavi or typical field mm-hmm. of studies that students of the seminary will take and get to the high levels, mm-hmm. he mastered, like jurisprudence, fiqh, yes. philosophy, very kalam, good. And exegesis, or tafsir al-Qur'an.
That's right.
For the last one, we have one of the actually famous tafsir that we have, at least in Iran, is Ravan-e Javid,
yes.
which is conducted by him
yes.
in 5 volumes.
Okay.
And it's a kind of simplifying what we have in Tafsir al-Safi, which is conducted by Faiz Kashani
yes.
almost 200 years before him. So he is saying that I actually wanted to dedicate my life to Quran, and I couldn't get chance. But
yes.
when he is almost 43 years old, he says that I get this tawfiq and chance to start
yes.
offering this tafsir,
okay.
and I wanted to conduct a kind of tafsir which is going to be
yes.
beneficial
yes.
for the ordinary people and
okay.
lay people.
And as my brother said, for the scholar, when he reaches this level, and then he moves back to his hometown, and he stays in the local, among the actually lay people in one of the oldest traditional neighborhood and district in Tehran, which is Pomenar.
That's
most
right.
of the, yeah. This is actually one
a
of...
A famous neighborhood in Tehran.
Yes, which includes many tourism sites as well.
Yes, yes.
So he stayed there till the end of his life. Mm-hmm. It shows how he was really interested in dedicating his life to the very important issue of tabligh and preaching religion among the ordinary people.
That's all right.
This is one of the advantage of him.
One of the most important people and the revivers of the Hausa in the city of Tehran. Most of the people might think that Tehran has no Hausa or a school or seminary one, but you know, Tehran has, you know, schools and different scholars are over there. He was also famous for compiling poetic collections or composing poems, you know, on the Ahlul Bayt, you know, and this made him great. But he is known with his tafsir, which is called Ravan Javid, by Mirza Muhammad Saqafi Tehrani. Give us some details about this tafsir or the exegesis of the Holy Quran by him.
As my dear brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, this tafsir is somehow a simplified version of tafsir marhum Mullah Faiz Kashani.
Tafsir As-Safi.
That is named Tafsir As-Safi.
Yes.
And you know, the method of Tafsir As-Safi is somehow putting ahadith and also, you know, historical events and also the some reasonings. He's trying to put these all together to give, you know, the clarification for the verses.
Okay.
So it's not only relying on ahadith, but also relies on other...
You mean historical and social facts?
Yes.
The
trying
background.
To put these facts together.
Okay.
But the mainstream is riwayat in Tafsir Mullah, in Tafsir As-Safi.
Okay.
The mainstream is riwayat. So that's why Marhum Thaqafi Tehrani decides to clarify this tafsir.
That's right.
First of all, because it was amongst the most recent tafsir that he had, you know, was in, you know, his achievement.
Yes.
So was the amongst the newest one.
Yes.
And beside that, he says that because this tafsir was relying on ahadith and also mentioning other points, that's why I chose this tafsir to simplify and clarify it for ordinary or lay people to get more benefits from the Holy Book of Quran. And
what is his main approach in this tafsir?
Yes, we may say that there are some good points, or we may say there are some, you know, interesting points regarding this book. That is, first of all, because he wanted to give a book and clarify this book for lay people, for ordinary people.
Yes.
He tries to emphasize the ethical points of tafsir.
Okay.
That's why we may say that this tafsir is an akhlaqi exegetic book.
So you mean an exegesis of the ayahs of the Quran, but with an ethical or, especially, educational approach?
Yes.
Okay.
Another important point is that he is trying also to mention some fiqhi or jurisprudential issues. Besides this, he tries, because Tafsir As-Safi, the main tafsir that Marhum Saqafi Tehrani is trying to simplify, is a narrative tafsir somehow.
Yes. Okay.
So Marhum Saqafi Tehrani is trying to put those ahadith that at first they seem to be in conflict with each other.
Mm-hmm.
He tries to put these ahadith under the same umbrella.
That's right.
And to show that there is no conflict between this riwayat, in a way that they are, in a way that they all are in the same, you know, stream, and they are giving the same message to the audience.
That's right.
And another important point is that the you know, text of the book, the sentences, they are simple, but They are easy understanding, but they are not giving simple issues. They are trying to give, important points, but in a way that is easy for, ordinary people to be understood.
You mean sophisticated concepts, but in simple words?
Yes.
Okay, this is what usually, the most outstanding ulama have tried to do. In the later centuries, we could find it on the exegesis of the Holy Quran, on Ahkam, on Etaqadat, and on different topics. When the simplified versions is out, usually there are sophisticated concepts and contents, but the language is simple to understand. Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
And the last point that we should mention regarding this tafsir is that this tafsir is not a long one. Mm-hmm. It's in 5 volumes.
Yes.
So we all know that a tafsir in 5 volumes is not a big one, because we have tafsir about 30 volumes, 40 volumes, more or less.
Yes.
So this tafsir is counted amongst those ones that may be used by ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, going into very, crucial details and to, bring the audience some sort of confusion that what is the last deduction and what is the last point that the author is trying to mention. For example, when you refer to tafsir Fakhrur Razi, he is giving different type of aqwal or, points. So in a way that the ordinary people, normal people, they may face with confusion that, what is your last point? So Tafsir Rawan Jawid is not trying to put the audience in confusion. He's trying to simplify the stuff as it is possible for the author.
Very good. This is what the public needs, simple to understand and easy to understand tafsir of the Quran. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, anything about Rawan Jawid tafsir of the Holy Quran?
Okay, I may have some contribution to what my brother just said as the approach that you asked for. We may add this as well, that he is saying that I was trying to compose or conduct a tafsir on the Quran, but for the reason Quran has revealed for, and that is the guiding the believers.
The book Hidayatul,
Hidayatul Muttaqin. So I was trying to mostly include these points, which have kind of relation with the guidance of Muttaqin or the believers. So this is another aspect of the approach that he has taken in his tafsir that I think we have to mention.
That's right.
But another aspect of his life is the poetry, composing poems. We have to say, I think it's not fair to ignore this part of his life, that he was really passionate poet when it would come to the position of Ahlul Bayt. We have a very nice poetry on Imam Ali, which is called Qasideh Ghadiriyye. He is starting like this. Actually, this is in Farsi. But I think our audience can get the notion of this poetry, which says, Ali Vasiy Rasul, Ali is Zawj Batul, ابو الائمه بر مؤمنان یگان امیر علی ولی و علی والی علی مولا علی است ساقی کوثر قسیم و خلد و سعیر. And another poetry that he has composed on Lady Ma'soomah, and he has called the poetry as the second Fatima.
Fatima Sani.
Yes, Fatima Sani. Second Fatima. And this is also nice that I actually recommend our audience to go and look it up and benefit and enjoy this poetry.
That's right. That's all right. Really beautiful poems regarding Imam Ali alayhi salam, Hazrat Ma'soomah, and the other members of the Ahlul Bayt, poetic collections of Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani. It was very kind of you. Thank you much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziya for your presence in the program, The Teacher, talking about Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani, the author of Rawan Jawid, Exegesis of the Holy Quran. It was very kind of you. About his demise, it's mentioned that it was Al-Ghada 22nd, 1405. According to the lunar Hijra calendar, he passed away in the city of Tehran. Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani, the author of Rawan Jawid, Exegesis of the Holy Quran, also the father of the late Khadija Saghafi, the wife of the late Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us, the program, The Teacher, on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and introducing another Shia dignitary, God bless you all. Fi aman Allah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.